Okay, it's time to start. Before I begin, I want to show you all something. I want to respond to some comments, and then I want to show you something that I think you'll find interesting. I think I have the technology to put it on my screen. I'm going to show, we've spoken in the past about the yeshivas, Tel's yeshiva, other yeshivas, Slabodka, how they had fights among the students and between the students and the faculty and all sorts of things like that. And often people assume that this is something of the past. I'm going to show you a video now. It's about a minute and a half of an event that took place last week. I'm hoping it was before the massacre in Jerusalem, when people could still think about the sort of nonsense we're going to see. But the scene is the main room in the Ponovez Yeshiva. And what you're going to be looking at least that's the description that was sent out with it, is for those who know about the Ponovez Yeshiva, it's split into two factions. And what you're going to see here is someone get up, it's time to daven Ma'ariv, from one of the factions, and as a protest, the other group of students do not let him daven. They start singing, and they prevent him from davening. And the description that went along with this said that this chazan and the group that was with him had to go to a separate room to daven. The description also says that the guy you'll see in the front, or I think you'll see in the front, urging people to come up, come forward, that he is actually, it says he's the grandson. I'm assuming it means the great-grandson of Rav Elyashiv. So be that as it may, I'm going to try to put it on my screen right now. It's, like I said, it's about a minute and a half. Okay, now I'm going to get back to you guys. I have to figure out how to now get back up. Okay, now I think I'm back. Okay, you didn't need to see it have such good quality. It just is a description, as I said, of, yes, that was Rav Povarsky. He's the people, I'm reading the description here, the people who are making all the noise are from the Markovitz contingent, who are opposed to Rav Povarsky, and that was him sitting on the corner there, in front, on the side of the Aron Kodesh. He's the one they don't support. So, yes, as Yechezkel says, he's from the ones they oppose. Also, before we begin, Yechezkel, who's on now, I mentioned, you just wanted to clarify, because we're always clarifying, that when we spoke about Amuka last week, it's not, on the outskirts of Tzfat. He wanted to clarify that. Someone emailed me, does anyone today, well, first they emailed me two things. Why don't we wear the small tefillin anymore? Which you'll see in museums and things, and also, does anyone still wear it? I think the reason we don't wear it is only, it's sort of, I think, like, when I was young, I used to go, Borough Park and Williamsburg. I used to do these Shabbases with the Hasidim, and I still remember the strimals, that they were somewhat thin. Maybe the Rebbe had a big one. Today, if you go there, you see the strimals look like spuddocks. That is, they're really tall, and they got to kill a lot more animals for that. And everything gets bigger, and I think it's the same thing with tefillin, that I don't know what to say. It's just you want to make it bigger, and sometimes the tefillin are almost huge. But there is, I will show you one picture, which I have here, of a great rabbi who still wears the small tefillin. Here you see it, very small tefillin. You will not have any bar mitzvah boy wearing tefillin that small. I guarantee you that the tefillin could be almost twice the size of his head. Does anyone know who this is? You can type in if you see. This is from last year on Purim. But like I said, you won't. There's an example of a small tefillin. No one types it in. That's Rav Yitzchak Abadi of Lakewood, who, if anyone is not moved by the changes in the Orthodox world, he's still wearing the tefillin he probably had 50 years ago. And as we mentioned, it's those sort of tefillin that enable you to put a second one. It would be on top of it. One more or two more things. I can delete him. From here, not delete, but to take his picture off. I'll send the picture if anyone wants. Actually, it's on from. I just pulled it off the Wikipedia page, but I had seen it, so I thought it would be interesting. I mentioned the woman Regina Jonas last week, and I wasn't sure if she got smicha from Chanoch Albeck, the famous author of the Mishnah. If you were in Mishnayos, you probably know the Albeck Mishnayos. Before Kahati came around, the Albeck was the standard, and it turns out I wasn't sure. He did not give her smicha. So I think we can say that Avi Weiss, or Bavi, is the first man to give a woman smicha, although they say Rav Shlomo Karabach gave smicha. I don't know. Ira says I should ask him about the Kapalah. Let me see. I pull it up again. Yes, you're right. Okay, maybe I have to go to Lakewood to get one of those. And finally, the last thing before we begin, this takes us back to the last semester, some discussion that we had, with Mel and myself about the story with Rav Soloveitchik and Lieberman, the argument where Lieberman said that he had this text which said that there's a problem of being tamei to a sheretz, and the Rav said, well, that's nonsense, and just like there are Amaratzim and today, there are Amaratzim and years ago, and this is described. When Rakefet describes it, and I think maybe Rav Schachter also, he talks about it as if this is something from the Geniza, a Geniza text, which would be a bit strange when you think of it, because by the time you get to the Geniza, medieval times, everyone should know that there's no issue of, no problem of being tamei from a sheretz, from a creepy crawly thing. There appeared an article I guess a year and a half, 2 years ago, it's a lecture, which then was spread about by Shama Yehuda Friedman. Lieberman had two great students. One was Halivni, one was Shama Friedman, and both of them are recipients of the Pras Yisrael. And he has an article on, I can send it to anyone, Lieberman and Rabbi Soloveitchik, and he explains what is going on here. It's not the Geniza at all. It's the Dead Sea Scrolls. In one of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is, I believe it's the Temple Scroll, it mentions that if you come into contact with the Sheretz, you are tummy. And that's the issue, and that makes a lot more sense. And then in that early period, when the Rav asked Lieberman, you know, what do you take it seriously? And Lieberman says he does, because you are talking about an era when you could have different traditions. You're talking about the formative era of Chazal, and that's the article, if anyone's interested. So it's not the Geniza, as has been repeated, it's the Dead Sea Scrolls. There is a very interesting article about Lieberman, actually directed against me, that came out a few weeks ago, by David Golinkin. You don't need to go looking for it, because it's actually going to appear on the Sfarim blog, hopefully in the next day or two. Well, I shouldn't say that, because I'm going to Florida, but I'll be able to probably proofread it when I'm in Florida. So maybe before Thanksgiving, the same article that appeared in the Journal of Conservative Judaism, in which he takes issue with me, will appear on the blog, and you can judge whether his points have any validity to them. Let us now pick up where we left off last time. The Ben Ish Chai, the last thing we were doing, I introduced this man, Jacob Obermeyer, who was working for one of the Persian princes there, and he was working for the French Alliance. And he wrote very negatively for the journal, where he was writing it from, Hamagid, yes, and Hamagid wrote very negatively about the Ben Ish Chai, and I read you a bit, and let me continue about on this as well. The first paragraph I read you is he spoke about, very interesting the statement, that the Ben Ish Chai was part like a Hasidish Rebbe and part like Geiger. Because he spoke about how the fact that the Ben Ish Chai got rid of certain customs. And he goes on, and this went on for a few different issues. He continues by talking about how the Ben Ish Chai was arrogant, he says. Why is the Ben Ish Chai arrogant? Because the Ben Ish Chai refers to the books he writes as, my holy books, or Sifri HaKodesh, my holy book. And he says, you know, previous scholars won't refer to their books as, the insignificant volume. And here, the Ben Ish Chai is going, Ben, at the end of the talk today, I'll go back and I'll answer all the questions, because now we're already started. The Ben Ish Chai refers to his book as the holy book. So that annoys Obermeyer to no end. The truth of the matter is that Obermeyer was wrong on this. The Ben Ish Chai writes, he refers to Bet Samech He Kuf, which does not stand for, it could stand for B'Sifri HaKodesh, but it doesn't in the case of the Ben Ish Chai. There's no question that it stands for B'Sifri HaKatan. So my insignificant book, exactly what Obermeyer said he should have said. So then he continues, as I said, he compares him to a Polish Rebbe that he knew, coming from that part of the world, who takes advantage of the ignorant followers. He in the next issue, he goes into the point that he made that he's like a reformer. Why is he like a reformer? Well, because there is a vidui, a confession that was practiced in Baghdad, going back to Rabbeinu Nissim. Rabbeinu Nissim, I don't know if he means the Ron or Nissim Gaon, where on Yom Kippur they would say, probably of Nissim of Girona, they would say this prayer that I bow down to you, be'ema, be'yira, all these expressions, and yira, pachad, rada. And what did the Ben Ish Chai do? He said that today we are not at that level that we can say that we really are have fear of God, ema, and all that, that we should just remove those words. And what does Obermeyer said? Well, then what are you going to do with all our prayers? All our prayers refer to this. So he's a reformist. And then another issue. This went on for three issues. He really goes after him. He says, first of all, that I've only told you a little bit about the bad things that the Ben Ish Chai does. He says that, first of all, he has no contact with the people. He's not like a rabbi. He sits at home all day. He has a job and he works in this as a merchant, so he doesn't need to ever go out. And nevertheless, he tries to lord himself over everyone else. And then he says this man Yosef Chaim Niflama Ode. He's wondrous. He doesn't go out. He's involved in his business, And he writes letters and does all these strange things from home. And what does he want to do? He makes it seem like he's a Parush for Kodesh, like he's very holy. He has a lot of books in his house. So he never comes to the Beit Midrash with everyone else. What he does is he learns a little bit with some Balabatim. He doesn't speak to the wise men in town in Divrei Torah. He doesn't have anything to do with people. He'll say a few words here and there, which no one can understand. He doesn't read the newspaper. He goes on and on and on. And then he says, all this, he shows a veneer of holiness. But this is all just for the outside, so people think he's holy. And it works, he goes on, Obermeyer, that the people relate to him just like a Polish Rebbe. They think he's some holy. They've made him into a best Sheni, a second Baal Shem Tov. And he ends this piece by saying that I hope that the Ben Ish Chai will do tshuva. And this isn't like some leading rabbi saying the Ben Ish Chai will do tshuva. This is a maskil saying that the Ben Ish Chai is very misguided. The response was not long in coming. The rabbis of Baghdad, even though it might have been true that the Ben Ish Chai didn't involve himself that much with them, they regarded him as a very holy man. They consulted him, they looked towards him, even though he wasn't a rabbi or involved in the community in any official way, and they regarded him as the leading authority of halacha in Iraq. Not surprisingly, they put Obermeyer in Cheirem, which meant that no one could have anything to do with him. Now, Obermeyer, maybe this might not have concerned Obermeyer. I don't know, if he was married, if his wife was with him there, because there was a machokas. If someone's put in cheirem, if the wife still needs to hold by the cheirem, some hold that even the wife needs to, in which case, if you don't know how to cook, you're in trouble, and others hold that the wife is exempted from the cheirem. But Obermeyer was placed under the cheirem, and during this period, his mother dies, and he needs to say Kaddish. And he can't say Kaddish because no one will come make a minyan for him, and he's not allowed to go into the shul. So he was forced to ask forgiveness of the Ben Ish Chai. He apologized to the Ben Ish Chai. The Ben Ish Chai did forgive him, and only then was he able to daven with a minyan. And the truth is that the Ben Ish Chai was not any sort of fanatic, as he's made out to be. He was not opposed to secular studies. He writes about it. We have a drasha of his where he writes about secular studies. And he says, to begin with, secular studies are valuable, and they are good, but don't mistake it. They're good in this world, in Olam Hazeh. They're not good for Olam Haba. That is, it's not going to guarantee you a place in heaven. So he's saying, put everything in perspective, that they have value in this world. And when did he express himself this way? He gave a drasha, this drasha, at the opening of a school in Baghdad, a school set up with the assistance of the French Alliance in order to educate Iraqi children. And the Ben Ish Chai was even president of the local Alliance committee. The fact that he was involved with the Alliance in any way shows that he was not opposed to children being given vocational training, to being taught the language of the country, all those sorts of things. Who's opposed to that? In Hungary, maybe. The fanatics in Hungary. Who else is opposed to that? The issues then come later with the Allianz when they want to bring in like more of a secular approach. But if it was just teaching them how to function in the world, no one would have been opposed to that. The Ben Ish Chai actually uses the term Derech Eretz. But he's not speaking about secular education the way Hirsch does. That is Western civilization when Hirsch uses it. Rather, he sees Torim Derech Eretz. For him, Derech Eretz is, it's practical. Students need to be given training so they could earn a living, and this is important, and you need to educate them in this. He also spoke about how it's important for the Jews in Iraq to speak a proper Arabic. Let me read you what he says here. This is all part of this drasha that he gave. He says, us sitting here in our city, the language of the city is Arabic. The problem is that we, that is the Jewish community, we don't speak good Arabic. they were speaking in Judeo-Arabic. And a non-Jew will come and speak to us in Arabic, and what happens? There are some words that the Jew doesn't know, he doesn't understand them. And then what does the Ben Ishchai say? Hayesh chisaron yoter mizeh? Shehadam eno makir lashono v'yodo? Is there any more of a chisaron, a lack, than someone living in a country doesn't understand the basic language? The language of the country? I've met people from Williamsburg and Kiryas Yoel, born in America. Not only do they speak with an accent, they hardly speak English. They're functionally illiterate. And if you've been reading the paper recently, I think it made the New York Post this week, not just in America, there's a case going on in Canada too, where the case in New York is this guy is suing the state of New York because the state of New York is obligated, there's a law that every school needs to teach basic secular education, and they are not enforcing it. It used to be they did, but they are not enforcing in these schools in Williamsburg. And he grew up a functional illiterate, and they're never going to enforce it. I don't think there was a time when they would, but today the Satmar votes are so important. But that's why he's going to court, and he's being funded by some modern Orthodox people, because the only way to force the state of New York to enforce this will be through a court order, because they know, the Department of Education knows exactly what's going on. And the same thing is happening in Canada now. Someone, if I recall from the Tush community, he also is a functional illiterate. It's a form of child abuse. They don't speak English or don't speak French, and they can't make a living. And according to the law, they have to do that. So that's why both places, lawsuits are taking place. And for the Ben Ishchai, of course you need to speak the language. He also writes about he supports modernizing the yeshivas. When I say yeshivas, I mean, let me put them up on the screen, by the way, so you see who we're talking about here. He supports, this isn't the only picture we have of him. There's another picture or two as well. He supports modernizing the yeshiva. What do I mean by that? Not modernizing like you might think of, no haskalah orientation, but let me just read you some of the things he says, that we need to make nicer buildings so it's cleaner and there's fresh air, and that's going to be better. Then he says, and this is a bit, maybe there are people opposed him on this, he says, it's time that we now sit in chairs. In Iraq, they used to sit, as they did in Yemen and all these places, they would sit, the Rebbe would sit in the front on the floor, and the students would sit around him on the floor. And the Ben Ishchai says, no, the students should all sit in chairs, not in a circle, but all facing the Rebbe. Why? Because sitting on the ground for a long time is not easy on you. It doesn't feel good. So we want to make it as comfortable as you can. So the Ben Ishchai shows that he's not afraid of changes. If it's going to work, it reminds me when these kanaim, these extremists, came to Rav Moshe Feinstein. They asked him, is it permissible to teach Torah in Hebrew, Ivrit? He had schools like Flatbush doing it, and they were expecting him to rule that it's forbidden, it's changing the Masorah. And his answer was, if that language is better for them, then that's okay. He thought that the American students should be taught in English because it's easier for them. But to turn this into an issue, obviously for kids in Israel, that's the language you teach them in. Then the Ben Ishchai says, you should sit in rows instead of sitting in a circle. Why not? Because if you sit in a circle or in a half circle, those people who are sitting on the side can't see the teacher straight away. They're seeing the side of his face. They can't see Pnei Hamora, and that's not good. You want to see his face. You don't want to be on the side of him. And he refers to them. This is the Ben Ishchai's language in his drasha. He calls these takanot tiviot. They're just not natural type of improvements. Anything that will be better for the students, that the learning goes into them, and they'll be able to accept it better, that's what we should do. So very practical. Let me read you another thing he said, along these same lines. He says that don't say you're only going to teach, this also appears in this drasha he gave. He says, don't say you're going to say, I'm just going to teach my student, just teach them Torah day and night. And I won't teach Ketiva, Lashon HaKodesh, V'Dikdush, V'Cheshbon. I won't teach them Hebrew and writing and grammar and Cheshbon. I guess this is probably mathematics. V'Yediot HaTeva, basic knowledge of the world. V'Inyanei HaOlam, Kamo Geografia, geography. Basically teach them things they can be intelligent and know about the world. A friend of mine who listens sometimes he's live with us, he emailed me that he shocked his nephew. He grew up, I mean, he's in the Haredi world. He's in Lakewood and everything, but he grew up in an era when there still was basic education. His nephew did not know who the first president of the United States was and took a guess and said Thomas Edison. And he was shocked. How could you be in this country and think Thomas Edison is the first president of America? Forget looking at your dollar bills and everything. So the Ben Ish Chai says that. Don't say that you're not going to teach them that. Rather, educate the child so that he understands these things. Because even though the Ikara Chinuch, the main Chinuch, has to be learning of Torah, grab this and grab that, but do it in a proper order. My friend who emailed me this, who teaches in a number of schools in Lakewood, three different yeshivas, he said that all the rabbeim his age, around 40, all support secular education for the kids. Basic secular, we're not talking about, to go to university or anything, but basic secular education. And many of the yeshivas hardly give anything today. So I asked him why. Why do they support that? He said, because it's too much to have the kids learning all day without a break. And the secular studies is a little bit more relaxed. And second, he told me, because it doesn't hurt them. And it'll help them. And it doesn't take away from their learning to have basic yedios. We're not talking about a modern Orthodox curriculum here. We're talking about basic secular studies to function in the world and be able to understand certain things. I'm going to go to the end. I'll go to about a half hour, 25 minutes more. Then I'll just go through all the questions. That people have told me that's better. That's easier. The Ben Ish Chai, throughout this period we're talking about, the end of the 19th, early 20th century, had halachic correspondence with rabbis throughout the Sephardic world and with some Ashkenazic rabbis. It's not like today. One of them he did correspond with. His name was Rav Shlomo El Yashiv. This is the grandfather of Rav Yosef Shalom El Yashiv, who was a great Mekubal. He actually knew Rav Kook in Europe, and then they reconnected again in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Shlomo El Yashiv wrote the famous The Leshem. It's a famous Kabbalistic work. And he was asked why he didn't have any approbations in it. It's a bit of a foolish question, I think, because usually you get an approbation from someone who's greater than you, who can attest to something. There was no one greater. Who knew Kabbalah in Lithuania that the Leshem is supposed to ask? But his reply was that he didn't have any askamot because the Ben Ish Chai saw the book and gave his approval. Even though he didn't write a letter in approval, he saw it. The Ben Ish Chai was a great Mekubal. The Ben Ish Chai is a great posek. He's a great darshan. That's all he did. He didn't function as a rab, but he would give drashas occasionally. He was also a chassid. When I say chassid, I don't mean a chassid as the Baal Shem Tov type of chassid, but his lifestyle was characterized by many maasei chassidut. Talk about maasei chassidut. I was listening today. Today was the final the day after Shiva for the Kedoshim in Eretz Yisrael. So if you go to the Torah Smosha website, you can watch. You don't have to listen. You can watch, actually. You can listen. The Hespedim. And one of the Hespedim, this was just for Ramosha Twersky, was by his brother, Rav Meir Twersky. You might have some Talmidim of Rav Meir Twersky from YU on right now. But he started speaking about his brother and his brother's Maaseh Chassidut. Of the sort that people didn't even know about it. And he mentioned about Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. He told that he met Rosh Hashanah ben Arbach's son, and he asked him, did Rosh Hashanah hold the time of Rabbeinu Tam, of when he was, you know, Moshe Shabbos? And Rav Shlomo Zalman's son said to him that until he was in high school, he didn't know the answer to this. That is, Shlomo Zalman was careful that not to let people know. That is, you know, he always would come up with reasons. You know, he'd stay at shul late. He'd talk to people by the time he got home, say Havdalah, that sort of thing. And then he spoke about Rav Moshe Tversky. And Rav Meir says that, you know, that's not something we should strive to emulate, because this is something special, unique. And I never knew Moshe Tversky, but from what I've heard in Hasvedim and read, he was a very special person, and he had unique aspects of Hasidut. And what Rav Meir Tversky said is that's not for us, and that's not even what we should look to, because he's a unique sort of person. And then Rav Meir spoke about the things that we can learn from him. What I can tell you about Rav Moshe Tversky, because it's relevant not to him as much, but we have many people who are followers of Rav Soloveitchik who listen to us, is that I'm assuming all of you know that I knew the family. I was his father, Yitzhak Isidore Tversky's last student. So, I was in the house. I used to go to his house. But that was a different era. Moshe went to Eretz Yisrael, I think, in 1984. So I never knew him. But he was actually roommates at Harvard with Alan Adler, and Adler wrote about this last week. Moshe Tversky went to Harvard, but even when he was at Harvard, he took the classes, he did what he needed to do, but it was kulo Torah. All he was interested in was learning. So he was asked, well, what are you doing? If all you want to do is learn, and let people know, as soon as he finishes college, he's going off to learn. He went to YU, he was at YU learning, and then he went to Israel. I don't know if he went to Brisk, although his sons were in Brisk. In fact, the guy I mentioned before, whose nephew doesn't know who Thomas Edison and George Washington are, he was a chavrusa with, or no, not chavrusa, he sat at the same table with Moshe Tversky, and he knows him very well. So when they asked him, why are you here then? All you want to do is learn. He said, listen to this. I'm here because my grandfather wants me to be here. Not his father. The Rav wanted his grandchildren to get a college education. So, l'chavod, to honor his grandfather's wishes, the Rav, Moshe Tversky went to university. He had no interest in it whatsoever. And unlike Meir Tversky, who's still involved in the secular world and the larger world, although I don't think there's any question he's more to the right of with his father and grandfather, but he isn't very much involved teaching at YU with the wider world, and his sister, who's married to Rabbi Rosenblatt of Riverdale. Rav Moshe Tversky basically joined the Haredi world, but he, in order to honor the wishes of his grandfather, he went to Harvard, and I think that's pretty classic of Rav Soloveitchik. And I would have liked to ask him if, you know, does he feel it was a waste? If you listen to some of his shiurim online now, and you listen to the intelligent way he speaks and he formulates, I challenge anyone to say that his learning was, or at least the way he expressed his learning and the way he was able to get it across, was not helped by the home he grew up in and by the secular education he received. But getting back to the Hasidut, the Ben Ish Chai was a Hasid. And in this giant, massive book, which weighs a ton and it's not cheap, let me tell you, but it has everything in here now. All the books he wrote, the years they were published. Unbelievable pictures. Not just of great rabbis, but of the Baghdad and other places in Iraq that we're not going to anytime soon. But in this book, anyone who has it, on page 243, it lists a number of 244. It lists a number of his Maase Hasidut, the holy things he did, which separated him from the average. And numbers 49 and 50, he gives certain vegetables, yerakot, that have small bugs and difficult to be bodek, to search them, he would not eat them. I think this is worth noting, because today we wouldn't consider this maase chasidut. Today this is pretty standard about the bugs, but this was not the case in early years. The Chayyadim writes about how the Aruch HaShulchan, how we can't get rid of these bugs. They're just everywhere. And he doesn't say, I mean, if you can see the bug, you don't eat it. But the idea of abstaining from food, they didn't think about that. And not only that, you have a limud schus by a number of poskim justifying how people can eat these vegetables when they're definitely bugs. If you look in them, you'll find bugs. And but the Ben Ish Chai was Hasid, and he abstained from these vegetables. The Ben Ish Chai was one of the people responsible for establishing the Porat Yosef Yeshiva. Porat Yosef Yeshiva in Jerusalem. So how does the Ben Ish Chai have anything to do with the Porat Yosef Yeshiva in Jerusalem? Well, there was a wealthy Iraqi Jew. Oh, and let me just go back and say, the Porat Yosef Yeshiva was the great yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael for Sfaradim. It really was the only yeshiva for Sfaradim. There was a yeshiva for Mekubalim, Shar Shamayim, the Ben Ish, not Shar Shamayim, Beit El. Shar Shamayim was an Ashkenazi yeshiva run by Rishon Zalman Rava's father. There's a yeshiva, Beit El, but that was a Kabbalistic yeshiva. But in terms of standard yeshiva, that was it, the Porat Yosef. And what did they have for the Ashkenazim? They only had two or three also. There was a wealthy Iraqi Jew in Calcutta, India. As I mentioned in previous classes, there was a large Iraqi expatriate population living in India. And he wanted to donate money for a good tzedakah. And he wanted to build a hospital in Jerusalem. That's a nice thing to do. But the Ben Ish Chai convinced him to build a yeshiva. He felt that there wasn't, as was put it, there wasn't a need for another place to heal the body, but they needed a place to heal the soul. So that's a nice suggestion. And the donor said, well, okay, I'll build it in Iraq. You say I should build a yeshiva? It should be right in Baghdad with the Ben Ish Chai. But the Ben Ish Chai told him not to, that the place to build this yeshiva was in Jerusalem. And when you look at all the great Sephardic Rabbanim, I don't know of any Ashkenazic rabbi who ever studied in Porat Yosef, but if you look at the Sephardic Rabbanim, all the great Torah scholars, say 60 years and older, they all studied, or 70 years, I should say, and older, they all studied in Porat Yosef, from Ravadia to Mordechai, I mean, the whole group of them. They all were there, Ben Sion, Abba Shaul, Rabbi Tzadka, all of them. That was the place to be. And that's where it was established, and it was established as a yeshiva where both exoteric nigla and also esoteric, the Kabbalistic literature, should be studied. That already distinguishes it from the Ashkenazic yeshivas, for whom there's no place for the study of Kabbalistic stuff. But in the Sephardic world, studying Kabbalah is something that didn't need to be hidden. You could do that. So this was even written in, that it's going to be a place of study of Nigla and Nistar, was written into the stone that was placed. They had a foundation stone that they put at the entrance of the yeshiva. I don't know currently. I've walked into the yeshiva once or twice, but anyone who goes to the old city, you know, the yeshiva, I don't know what they currently do there, and I don't even know if they have that stone. I'm assuming not, because the yeshiva was destroyed in the Six-Day War. It was destroyed after 1948 and was rebuilt after the Six-Day War. Everyone's going crazy around the world with this notion that some settlers want to destroy the Dome of the Rock, or Al-Aqsa. A survey just came out that most Palestinians in Israel actually accept the idea that Jews should be able to pray on the mount if they want to. But leaving that aside, because it is a very provocative thing, and it's not worth creating all the terrible things, be that as it may, the world should remember that Jews have never destroyed these holy sites of others. If you want to know who's destroyed holy sites, well, look what happened to the old city of Jerusalem from 1948 to 1967. All the shuls and everything was destroyed, and Jews were not permitted to enter. Even though it was in the armistice agreement, Jews were permitted to go to the holy sites. What happened to the cemetery, Jewish cemeteries, where the Intercontinental Hotel is on the mountain there? They destroyed that many parts of that as well. What did the Muslims do to churches? What did they do to the statues of the Buddha in Afghanistan? So this idea that they need to worry about us is a little laughable. But the yeshiva was rebuilt after 67. In addition to the building that was destroyed, the yeshiva had a great library, not just of Sfarim. Sfarim can be replaced, usually, but they had manuscripts, many, many manuscripts, going back a long time, of great Sephardic Rabbanim. And all that was lost when the yeshiva was destroyed. The when the battle was going on for the old city, and all appeared lost, the soldiers were willing to continue fighting. One of the people in there was Rav Shaya Yashav Cohen, currently of Chief Rabbi of Haifa, who was captured and held for a long time. It was two old Haredi rabbis, to use the term Haredi. I don't know, maybe I shouldn't use that term. It wasn't very fashionable then, and it wasn't so descriptive. But they were the ones who took out the white flag because they said, enough. We have to give up the town, give up the old city. It's just going to lead to more loss of life. And if you think of it, it's very similar to what happened in the days of the Second Temple, where you had these zealots who were willing to continue fighting until the last Jewish life. And but the rabbis, or at least the way it's described in the Talmud, recognized that we don't have this notion of better dead than red, or better dead than losing the holy city. We lost the holy city 2,000 years ago, and we got it back. We are patient people, and there's no need to fight to the death, especially what happens 19 years later. We were able to get the old city again. The Ben Ish Chai remains. He does not go to Eretz Yisrael. He doesn't. He remains, lives, and dies in Baghdad. And he's buried in Baghdad. We don't know where he's buried. We know which cemetery, but we don't know where in the cemetery. Let me read you now. And there were Jews when the, and I'll talk more about this because this class is also relevant to the matter of all the documents that were found that were brought back to America. You had Jews who examined these documents, and I was, when I was in Washington, D.C. a number of years ago, I had Shabbos dinner with someone who worked for the military, and this was Shabbos on Sunday or Monday. He was going to Baghdad when we still had a large presence there. You could go then to around synagogues and things. But in the big book, which was published just a couple of years ago by Rav Yaakov Moshe Hillel, on page 336, it says as follows. First of all, it has a picture of in the old cemetery of the Ben Ish Chai's kever. You can see it here. It's the big one. What happened is, though, and this is how it describes it in the book here, that until 1961, we knew where the Ben Ish Chai's kever was. In that year, the government of Iraq forced the Jews to dig up all the graves in the old cemetery. They gave him a few months, and all the graves, including that of the Ben Ish Chai and his son, were moved, his son was Yaakov, were moved to the new cemetery. And this book says that today it's impossible to identify the graves because over the years the climate, the difficult climate, has made the Matzevos disappear. So we used to know where it was because we used to know the site of it. But you couldn't read the Matseva. But now that they've moved it, we don't know. And they never took an exact survey of where they put everyone. His information seems to always be accurate. So I'm assuming this is as well. But having said that, if one day it is possible to go back to Baghdad, you will have people going there and they will search. And you might find it. I'm pretty certain that when they reburied the Ben Ish Chai, they didn't just put him in a regular grave. They must have done something to make it nice, bigger. I'd be a little surprised if we could not find where the Ben Ish Chai was located. Those who've been to my Central Europe trip, you know that the graves of Gedol Yisrael are kept separate. They're kept different. And when Jews need to when they had to move the graves, for example, the old cemetery in Pressburg, they were able to keep a few people there. They had to move others, but you're careful if you have to move an important person to put him somewhere. Actually, the truth is, it's not a good example, Pressburg, because Pressburg, they were able to keep all the important people where they were. But other times where they've had to move important people in Vilna, elsewhere, they always kept a marking of where they were. So I would be quite shocked that if one day we get to go to the old cemetery in Baghdad, we could not locate, and there are people, we've located just in the last few years graves of important rabbanim. you know, I'm on my feet here, so I'm not 100% sure, but am I wrong? It rings a bell. I think they find Ruby Stroll Saunders' grave in Kenningsburg just last year. I have to check that. I don't want to say 100% because maybe I'm confusing with someone else, but I'm 99% sure they found Ruby Stroll Saunders' grave. I'll check on that, maybe, unless I'm confusing with another Gadol, but I'm positive they found it, and we thought it was lost. And we found other graves, because there's these funds that are coming from non-Jews in America and elsewhere. It's amazing when you think of it, to fix up cemeteries. I'll get back to you next week if my memory is playing tricks with me, but I believe it's Rabbi Shaul Saunter. Unless I'm mistaking him, it's his son's grave. I'll get back to you next week. It's hard to do this on the fly sometimes. So Ben Ish Chai is buried in Baghdad. Of that, there is no doubt. And, okay, I'm going to have to look at that Yechesel after the class. And if you look in here, that's all it tells you. Nothing else. But if you go, there's a very interesting website called findagrave.com. Not that I need that for what I'm telling you right now, but people put in any important grave there. But as I said, I don't need it for that. But just if you want to do it, you can see it. And there's an entry for the Ben Ish Chai stating that he is buried on the Mount of Olives. Not only is stating that, let me show you the picture of his grave. There it is. You go to the Mount of Olives, and look what you see in the background right there. And you see his grave. Not only that, let me enlarge this for you for a second here. I'm on a different computer here, so I have a bit of a problem. I can't enlarge the picture. Maybe tech support can enlarge this picture for a minute. Let me see something here. I just want to make sure it's not just because it's a picture, but... yeah, okay, I'm not going to be able to enlarge it. It says it's not an MP3. I mean, it's what they call a JPG, I think. I'll read it for you. Sorry, can we put his cover up again? If you look at his headstone, it says, and it says Ben Ish Chai, Rav Pealim, giving all the titles that he used for his books, Rav Pealim, we're going to talk about his responsa soon, that's the title, it comes from Tanakh, the same Pasuk that mentions Ben Ish Chai, Rav Pealim, it comes to all these things that he used for reasons we spoke about last class, but Rav Pealim, the name of the responsa, and he's referred to it here. Someone, one of our listeners, doesn't listen live, but he emailed me, showed me an article. Someone wrote about the responsa and called it Rav HaPoalim, as if he's a rabbi of the workers. But look what it says. It says he's from the remaining members of the Knesset HaGdolah, you know, the great rabbis. And then it says he died, he gives the date of his death, 1909. And then, Lefi Edut HaMekubal, according to the testimony of the Mekubal, Rav Avram Adis, that he dreamed about the transferring of his coffin from Babylonia, from Bavel, to Jerusalem, Har HaZeitim, Gam BeHekitz BaKavron. That is, this is real. This isn't just a dream that he dreamed that the Ben Ish Chai was transferred. No, that this was... it really happened. In real life, that it actually happened. And then it goes on, Gam BeHekitz BaKavron, in reality. So you have a dream, but then in reality, the grave digger comes to Ben Zion Chazan. Ben Zion Chazan was a leading Iraqi rabbi, and he asked him for some money, Chatzi Razahav, to dig this kever. And, he was buried next to his uncle, Abdullah Moshe Chaim, because according to the Kavran, according to the gravedigger, that was the wish of the family who were at the cemetery, or Ben Zion Chazon, And Rav Ben-Tzion Chazan went to the gravedigger to the place and saw this. And he paid right on the spot. They're giving the whole story here because they have to give the story. Because who's going to believe it otherwise? We know he's buried in Baghdad. He never was brought here. And he wasn't brought here when he was dead. He was magically transported here. And we have the dream of Avram Adis telling us, but we have more than a dream. We have somehow the body, doesn't explain how, but it shows up at this gravedigger, and he brings it to, he goes to Ben-Tzion Chazan, and the idea that the gravedigger might, someone drops a body off at his house, and he thinks it's Ben Ishchai, that I can understand. How Ben-Tzion Chazan, someone comes to him and says, I have the body of the Ben Ishchai, and he's taken in by this, but the reason he's taken in by this, that's why it's so important in the first part, is because Rav Avram Adis had a dream that the body was brought. So Rav Avram Adis has a dream, and then directly after that, the day after or something, this guy, gravedigger, comes and says that we have the Ben Ishchai's body is with me. That's why he was believable, and he paid for it. And what can I say? That's there you go. You're looking at the grave, and people come to visit it. I already mentioned that this is even more than most of these graves. You have these Moroccan rabbis who, they don't have a story. They just, we know they where they died. We know they were buried. But now, today, in Israel, as we speak, you have graves that simply says their name, and people will come to these graves without even giving you a story that it was transported. Let me read you this book by Azulai, which I said when I dealt with it the first class that it uses the standard Hebrew works, doesn't have the original research, even though it's very interesting and a good read. I was referring to the first part. Once you get to the second part, it's all original, that his own research. So I don't want to say something that isn't true, but he says on page, he tells the story as well on page 247, 248, and he quotes Rav Yaakov Kassin. Yaakov Kassin later becomes, he's from Jerusalem. He becomes I think he's from Jerusalem. He's from the land of Israel. I believe he's from Jerusalem. He comes, and for 50 years, he's a rabbi of the Syrian community, the official rabbi. There are other rabbis in the Syrian community. He's the official rabbi. And it's his son today, who's also the official rabbi, quite elderly. Son was the one involved in that the problem. If you've read the book on the I forgot what it's called, the Jersey something or another, you all remember the story about the financial scam. But he writes as follows. Or he states, and it's recorded. On the night of the 13th of Elul, after midnight, the Kabbalist Rav Avram Adis, he dies in 1925, was immersed in Torah study in his usual manner when he suddenly fell asleep. In his dream, Rav Avram Laniado, he was a great sage, but he wasn't Iraqi, if I'm not mistaken. I think he's Syrian. He saw Rav Avram Laniado dressed in white. This doesn't appear on the tombstone, but someone who was living in the land of Israel, who this is the story that was going around. Rav Avram asked him where he was going, and he answered, "You should know that Rav Yosef Chaim passed away in Bavel, and I am going to accompany him to Jerusalem." Rav Avram Adis awoke, and then fell asleep again. In his dream, he saw the Ben Ishchai's bier, a huge crowd that had gathered, and certain rabbis whom he recognized delivering eulogies. He awoke again. Obviously, no one in Jerusalem had yet heard of the Ben Ishchai's passing. Rav Avram Adis understood that the events revealed to him in his dream were true. In the morning, he visited the Chachamim of the Babylonian Iraqi community of Jerusalem and asked them if they had received any updates about Rav Yosef Chaim's health. They answered that they had heard he had fallen ill several days earlier. Rav Avraham remained silent and did not reveal anything about the dream. Several hours later, a telegram arrived in Jerusalem from Baghdad announcing that Rabbeinu had passed away at dawn on the 13th of Elul. Rabbi Avraham then revealed that he had seen in his dream that Rabbeinu's bier had been brought to Jerusalem. He told them which rabbi should eulogize him and in which sequence, as he saw in his dream, and this is precisely what they did. I'd like to know who the person that they buried was. That's my question. Rav Kaduri, he's the, if you want to know a successor in terms of Makubalim from Iraq, he's the successor. He totally rejected this idea and said that the Ben Ishchai is buried in Baghdad. Of course he's buried in Baghdad, but here you have an incredible thing that we're looking at a tombstone here of someone who, by the way, one more thing. This is the only tombstone on the Mount of Olives that's standing up. Every other tombstone is horizontal on the Mount of Olives. That's the minhag to do it there. I'll pick up with this strange story next class. I do encourage anyone who's going to Eretz Yisrael to track down this grave and go visit. I have never visited, and the reason is simple. I've been there in the Mount of Olives, and I visited many great sages there. Rav Kook, the whole area, and the Hasidic Rebbes. I'm not sure where this is, but to be honest, until I started researching the Ben Ishchai, I had never heard this story. I knew nothing about this grave. I spent, not last summer, the summer before when I was in Israel, I spent probably 5 hours in the great cemetery there, going through the different graves. The people you see there, these are, I don't want to say my friends, but people I live with every day, people swore in my learned. I had no idea. I see their graves, and it's really something. So let me take some comments and questions, and we'll end here. Other than the questions, I'm going to go back and read all these comments right from the beginning. Ben says, is there a touch of irony that the Dead Sea Scrolls hold by too much Shratzim and their own Kalim could be so? I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that. So email it to me. Yecheskel says, if he felt that the Ben Ishchai was in the wrong, he should have stood by his guns. Okay. Ira points out, not odd, I read it because the people who listen in, they don't see it. Not odd if you appreciate the difference between a maskil and an apikores. He did need to say Kaddish. Yeah, just because he's a maskil, he needs to say Kaddish. It used to be that when you put someone in Cherem, it was a big deal because they could have been a Rasha, they could have been, whatever they could have been, but they still need to go to Shul on Shabbos. And they needed to, so putting him in Cherem, that accomplished something. Ben says that he used to live next to an elderly woman who was the daughter of one of the Chachamim of Baghdad in the era of Ben Ishchai. She told me all the rabbis had businesses. They even moved cities of residence if business required. Chacham Sabato writes, someone who looks strange to be Christian by Obermeyer. It was hardly rare. No, it wasn't that. It was the fact that he didn't have any function in the community as well. Rabbis had jobs. Rav Nissim, by the way, worked as well. He was a business person. But together with that, they had official positions. They were on the Beis Din, or they were considered a rabbi. They made their living, same thing in Yemen, they made their living often at the business, but they still were recognized as the rabbi, or the rav, or on the Beis Din. The Ben Ishchai was none of that. And Obermeyer's saying that he has nothing to do with the people, he stays inside all day. Yecheskel says he's yet to meet a kid so sheltered he doesn't know George Washington. Yecheskel, maybe you should travel. Travel to Kiryas Yoel. By the way, we weren't dealing with Kiryas Yoel here. We were dealing with a Litvish person. But was the Baal Shem Tov also a chassid? The Baal Shem Tov was not a chassid the way I described the Ben Ishchai. The Vilna Gaon is called a chassid. Just look at all the literature that talks about the Vilna Gaon in his lifetime. He's called Hagon HaChassid MiVilna. When I say a chassid, I'm talking about someone who was ascetic, who's doing acts of holiness. The Besht is a different type of chassid, not this sort of chassid. There's a whole phenomenon, which in the academic world we refer to as pre-Beshtian chassidim. You had, for example, a Klois in Brody, where these people were mekubalim, and they'd go to the mikveh constantly, and they would wear maybe woolen clothing so that they wouldn't wear woolen clothing, so they wouldn't have shotness, perhaps. Maise chassidut. When you get to the Baal Shem Tov, the word means something else. Uh, Yechezkel says they just found where Baruch Bear's grave. Maybe. Okay. And you go down. I'm not sure. Yechezkel gives us a link here to Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Something about Rishalter's grave. Yes. Anyone looking on that link, this is from last year, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's grave has finally been located. So I did not, my memory is not gone totally yet. Am I planning on leading a trip to Iraq? It's a joke. It's a good joke. But it's not such a joke because people asked me last summer, they've asked me for the last few summers, will I lead a trip to Morocco? Because I know a lot about Morocco. I've been there twice. I know all about the rabbis of Morocco. We could have a great trip. And anyone who asks me, I say, then definitely go to Morocco, but only as an individual. I don't feel comfortable taking a group to Morocco. I don't know what's going on there. There was a French guy in Algeria was kidnapped a few months ago by ISIS and killed. All we need to go as a group to a place like Morocco, even though it's very friendly to Jews, all you need is a couple people, ISIS sympathizers. So just like Turkey, wouldn't go to Turkey. So no, I'm not going to Iraq anytime in the future. Okay, I'll stay on for one or two more minutes. A few people are typing. No one has written in that they know they've ever been to this kever, so I'm assuming you haven't. Yisrael says, is there anything left of Jewish Baghdad? No, nothing. In next class, we'll talk about the archives, how they were confiscated and what became of it. Every now and then you'll have an article in the New York Times, you know, the last two Jews in Afghanistan who didn't talk to each other? There's a few Jews, if you look on, you look online, you'll find, I think there's like 50 Jews left in Baghdad, maybe 100. I don't think there's any Jews left anywhere else in Iraq. But for whatever reason, people have businesses, people are always looking for the future, but there's nothing left in Baghdad. It's like, forget Baghdad only. There's communities in a lot of these cities. It's no different than all these other areas in Poland and Germany, which have nothing left. Ira says that as a kid in Williamsburg, he remembers a joke that their parents were told that George Washington was not the current president, long dead. The parent replied, didn't even know he was crunk. Didn't even know he was sick. You can go on YouTube and you can find these guys like Sean Hannity and others who go up to people, usually in the inner city, and they ask them all sorts of strange things like, is it true that you support John McCain as Obama's running mate? And they'll say, oh yeah, he'd be great as a running mate. I mean, there's a lot of people who, the level of ignorance is pretty incredible. Yechezkel says the academic community views the Besht as a new type of chassid. Well, what does it mean to be a chassid? If a chassid means someone who is an ascetic, someone who adopts all sorts of stringencies, which is what it meant in the case of the Vilna Gaon, in the case of the pre-Beshtian chassidim, well, then the Besht is not a chassid in that definition. If a chassid means one who wants to relate to God through song and Torah study is not the be-all and end-all, and that prayer could take the place, everything that the Hasidic movement adopted, then he is a chassid. All I'm saying is that even what the Besht advocated, you had people, he wasn't the first, but when you refer to the Vilna Gaon as a Gaon HaChassid, which is what everyone referred to the Gra in his lifetime, the chassid, even Rishneir Zalman of Adi in his letter refers to him as a chassid. They were not referring to him in the same way as the Besht was a chassid. The chassidim did not like the opponents, and therefore they referred to them as mitnagdim. That was a term coined by the chassidim. But as I said, the Vilna Gaon was known as the chassid. Yechezkel said the stories they tell about him make him sound like a full-fledged chassid. I don't know what stories you heard, Yechezkel. I grew up hearing these stories. And I heard all the stories about how the Beshtet Kafitzas HaDerech and all the things, the miracles he could do and all that. I was never told stories that made him like the Vilna Gaon. You know, someone who was constantly learning and who was an ascetic. The whole idea of Chassidus is about the Gashmius. I was never told any stories approximating the stories that you hear about the Vilna Gaon and the other pre-Beshtian Chassidim. You know, sitting and learning Yomam Balayla, learning Kabbalah. Is that rabbinical? Yishol says, is that rabbinical garb in the photo, or did all the Jews dress like that? I'm not sure which photo you're referring to. Okay, I can't go into now more about the Besht and everything. Oh, open to secular studies, Parnassus Kabbalah. Why is Sfarim so much more open? Every figure in the Sephardic world we've dealt with has been open. A lot of this has to do, in my opinion, with the fact that it's not my opinion, I think it's pretty obvious. You had the development of a reform movement, and then you had Haskalah. So the reaction to that is always going to be much stronger. In the Sephardic world, you never had these trends. So therefore, the tradition developed much more naturally. If you remember when we dealt with Rav Mesas, both Rav Mesases, and we came across some very liberal, unusual halachic views, my point was that much of Ashkenazi Pesach is based on this idea that you're responding to problems, and therefore you have to move in a stringent direction because of the false heterim being given by the conservative reform and the like. If you never had these alternative movements, these divergent movements, and you want to know how halacha would develop organically, naturally, you can see that in the Sephardic world. The Sephardic world never had an orthodoxy. It never responded. It never had to attack anyone. It never created these barriers. Go online. You'll hear, if you plug into YouTube, name Mazuz, Ashreinu Sha'anachnu Sfaradim. You'll hear Rav Mazuz's talk, why it's so great to be a Sfaradi. Ashreinu Sha'anachnu Sfaradim, because we have a different approach. We don't attack people. We don't put them in Cherem. He says only once did the Sfaradim ever put a people in Cherem. He's wrong, by the way, because we just saw they put Obermeyer in Cherem. But he says Spinoza. Spinoza's that's all. Now, on the one hand, Mazuz is correct that the Sephardic world is a much more open and much more tolerant. On the other hand, the reason is they didn't have the heretics and the problems the Ashkenazic world had. It's not like, and those who know my blogs know that I regard Rav Mazuz as really the Gadol Hador. With all due respect for him, it's not that the Sephardim are just naturally better and more likable and nicer and open that leads them to this. Maybe there's some of that, but the reason the Ashkenazim were the way they were is not because they're just natural-born fanatics. It's that only in the Ashkenazic world did you have reform, did you have atheists, did you have divergent movements, conservative, etc. In the Sephardic world, you had one Gehila. Some are more religious than another, so it makes perfect sense that the Sephardim would be much more tolerant and open. If the Ashkenazic world had that, you wouldn't have groups of Hungarian fanatics, and you wouldn't have extremist Haredim and all that. That's the way to explain it. Although the people like Rav Mazuz and the rest try to say we come from this tradition of Spain, and yes, it is true that if you go back to Spain, the Jews in Spain were much more open and much more liberal than many of the Jews in the Ashkenazic world. But not all of them. And you had Jews in Provence who were all Ashkenazi, or not all, but you had many who were Ashkenazi who were just as liberal and just as open-minded. So I think the extremism in the Ashkenazic world is a response to the extremism from the non-religious. It's not warm weather, and it's not lack of persecution. It's what I said. Yeah, I got it. Yeah. Okay. Ira makes a good point. In Eastern Europe, the Ashkenazim, the Hasidim, never pride themselves on not knowing who these basic things. We talked about Sephardim. Sephardim are supposed to be open-minded. I'm not going to mention the name, but there's a certain Sephardic rabbi who, if you go to pizza shops and places like that, you can get his tapes, CDs for free. And I took one. I drive a lot, and I'm listening in the car, put it in my car radio there. And he's giving a shiur. One thing common to him and the rest of them is when you think about the proud Sephardic tradition represented by people like Rav Mazuz and people we've dealt with in this class, going all the way back to listen to some of these preachers, these Sephardic preachers, and the level of the infantile level which they're at. It's a real busha. And I was told by one of the Syrian rabbis when I listened to us, I said, how could anyone listen to this? He said, you'd be shocked. Who comes out for this? He himself, as a member of this community, it's embarrassing to him. But someone made a comment and mentioned the name Bill Gates. And the rabbi says, he's Israeli, but he speaks a fluent English, and it doesn't matter if he's Israeli, especially it shouldn't matter. He says, who? Bill Gates? He says, I don't know who Bill Gates is. And people are gasping. He says, someone says, well, how could you not know who Bill Gates is? He says, Baruch Hashem, I don't know who Bill Gates is. And he's proud of that. You would not have had that years ago. And if he wants to be proud, he doesn't know who Bill Gates is. Let him be proud. Yisrael says, would a 19th century Sephardic scholar study of the Gemara be like that of an Eastern European, even though they know contact? No, very different. We're going to talk next class. I'm going to review for you the introduction to the Ben Ish Chai. The introduction to the Rav Pealim, where the Ben Ish Chai discusses the difference between Ashkenazic and Sephardic approaches in learning and why the Sephardic approach is better. Yisrael asks, Rav Avadya look to the Ben Ish Chai or did he overturn the Psak? Rav Avadya's goal was to overturn the Psakim of the Ben Ish Chai, although he regarded the Ben Ish Chai as a great scholar and would cite him all the time. When the Ben Ish, as a practical matter, day in and day out, once the Iraqi community came to the land of Israel, it was now time to go back to the Shulchan Aruch. There's numerous times where the Ben Ish Chai differs with the Shulchan Aruch because of Kabbalistic considerations. And Rav Avadya wrote a multi-volume work called Halichot Olam, in which he goes through all the Ben Ish Chai and explains where we diverge. And this goes back to the 1950s. When he started with this, and when we deal with Rav Avadya, after Rav Chanan Wasserman, I'm going to do Rav Avadya the middle years, and you'll see what became of Rav Avadya because of that. Okay. Well, thank you all, and let me just wish you a happy Thanksgiving, and for those who celebrate it with the family, and we'll pick up next week. One more thing, Yecheskel says, okay, he's pointing out some Sfarim. I'm not sure why he's pointing out. Yisrael says, what's Thanksgiving? You know the old joke that American Haredim used to like to get the Israel. This is a joke. I'm assuming it's a joke. The old joke was that Israeli American Haredim, who would like to get Israel Haredim mad, would say that at the Aguda Convention, which until this year was always on Thanksgiving, you know, at the Aguda Convention, they're so makir tov to America that they even take out, they do Kriyas HaTorah. They read the Torah on Thanksgiving. They regard it as a Yom Tov. And if the guy didn't believe it, he could say, you know, you're not going to take an oath here, but I promise, they read the Torah on Thanksgiving Day. What Israeli ever knows what day Thanksgiving comes out on? So, the OU also has their convention. The old difference used to be that the OU would serve turkey on Thanksgiving, but the Aguda would not serve Thanksgiving, but I don't know why they moved it. Ira, you were already in Italy, weren't you? Weren't you in Florence? That's the report I got. My friend, the owner of the restaurant in Florence, tells me so. Simcha. If you have trouble registering, send an email into Torah in Motion to Rabbi Kelman or email it to me. I'll forward it to him. But I thought Simcha told me that you were already there. But if you were not there and he's referring to someone else, then we welcome you. If you were there, we welcome you. You will see great things. Mel is on with us right now. Then it's a different Ira, but this is Ira Gruscott, right? Rabbi Ira Gruscott? Okay, well then if you He mentioned a rabbi. Then he's confused. I don't know how he got your name, or he said Rabbi Ira somewhere or another, and I maybe misunderstood him. But be that as it may, Mel was with us in Italy. He can attest. Neil F., who's on with us, was with us in Italy. And we had a great time, and we'll continue to have a great time. And look, anyone else listening live or not listening live, we already have people signed up, and I love these trips. And what can I say? It's Mirtz Hashem, we should all be healthy and have another great experience, and give chizuk to the Jews living there. It means a lot. Now, we don't just get something out of it, but to come to these communities, a lot of these people, you know, they're stuck there. They can't go to Israel, and to see Jews from the world come and be join with them on Shabbos and other times, it really means a lot to them. And I tell you that as someone who's been to these places in the winter when there's no one there, and sometimes you don't even get a minyan. Being there in the summer, we really bring joy to them, and we have a great time as well. So thank you, Ira. Look forward to it. Good night, everyone.